Welcome to The Kicker. I'm your host, Megan Greenwell. Today, I'm really excited to have as my guest, Emily Sweeney. If you don't know who Emily Sweeney is, you clearly have not been on the internet very much recently. She is the Boston Globe reporter who went incredibly viral for a video talking about a crazy home invasion on Massachusetts' North Shore. But what went viral about the story was not actually the story, it was Emily herself. She has a cool look, she wears track jackets, and she has a really thick Boston accent. She's also just really smart about engagement and thinking about relationships with readers in new ways. Emily Sweeney, welcome to The Kicker.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I was so excited to have you. Like so much of the nation, I got really captivated by you a month or so ago and have now watched all of your videos. So I guess to set us up, tell us a little bit for people who maybe live under a rock and have not encountered you yet. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of your video about the Beverly home invasion on March 31st.
Yeah, so I'm a reporter at the Globe, and I cover a lot of breaking news. The story was about a robbery that happened at this huge mansion up in Beverly, up on the North Shore, and there's a community called Pride's Crossing, which is very affluent, and this mansion was like 28,000 square feet. Somebody, a masked intruder, came in and, was dragging the caretaker around and left with valuables. And we didn't have a lot of information at the time, but, you know, the Globe often has reporters, you know, talking about the stories they're working on. And we do, you know, vertical videos, like a lot of other news outlets. And that's what I did. And so I was, you know, I've done these before. And I don't know if it was like the amount of words that had like ER at the end of it, but apparently my accent came out quite a bit. And in addition to being like an interesting, you know, kind of crazy news story, a lot of people were commenting about my accent and what I was wearing at the time while giving the news report.
So let's step back for 1 second first. Tell me about how much video you had done for the Globe before then, like when it was a part of your work, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I've been working with video ever since I could get my hands on, you know, a digital recorder. I was one of the first reporters at the Globe to actually, like, make videos while I was out reporting stories. And this was, like, many, many years ago, early on my career. So I've personally always worked in video. I know how to edit videos, and I always enjoy being on camera and explaining things. The Globe, you know, we have a whole video department that wins like Emmy awards, you know, and we've done a lot of work in video. And there's been a recent push to get more reporters on camera. You know, I've appeared in a bunch, and you know, like I said, if you really do a deep search, I mean, you can find videos of me going back years and years. But this one, you know, it happened to take off.
Yeah, this was the first time in a long time I could remember a journalist like going viral, literally just for doing their job, right? Like, it wasn't a funny blooper. It wasn't going viral for the craziness of the story, even though, as you point out, the story was really crazy. It was just like people liked you, which is cool. I mean, it was fun to see like a fellow journalist like attract that kind of attention. When did you realize like something is different with this video than the reception than the other ones I've done?
You know, it was overnight. The next morning when it had like 900,000 views, I was like, whoa, wait a second. This isn't, you know, this doesn't match up to all other videos. That was honestly the first thing. I really thought it would be a one-off too, you know, like it was just like a crazy thing, like went around. But, you know, I got to give credit to the Globe for giving me the chance, because so many people were commenting like, you know, hey, like, let Sweeney read the headlines, you know, and I was commenting back too, like, I would love to, you know, because I would. And, you know, credit to the Globe and our social media team and our video team for like, you know, they're like, hey, like let's let Sweeney read some headlines the next day. And I did. And that video also like did really, really well. We got like, you know, audience engagement through the roof. And yeah, it's been like that. I mean, obviously the views haven't been like in the millions, but the engagement, you know, I'm still seeing a lot of traction. So mm-hmm. far, so good.
That's awesome. So I was reading a story you wrote years ago, and you said you actually wanted to be a TV journalist when you were younger, but you didn't see how someone who looked like you would fit into TV news. So tell me a little bit about your relationship with that kind of journalism and why it was so appealing to you.
Yeah, so I've always enjoyed talking face-to-face, just like we're not in person right now, but, you know, just talking with people, whether it's out in the street interviewing people or even me explaining things on camera. I don't know. This is something about like having a person just like, you know, and talking with somebody and talking to somebody. That's always been my favorite, you know. Obviously I'm a writer as well. So I've written and I write, you know, to this day, but you know, that part has always been really special to me. And mm-hmm. that's why I jumped into video as soon as I could, even at the Globe, before we even had like video, like the like platforms to put our videos on. I was like shooting video while I was interviewing people. But I mean, in broadcast journalism, broadcast news, even today, you don't really see many people, you know, who look like me, like even right now, you know, or who talk like me, just like kind of like a regular person, you know. And I'm just happy that, you know, people were, you know, had such positive response, because I would like to do more of it. And I think it's more of the future, because, you know, maybe like decades ago, a guy, like a white guy, like behind a desk with like a suit and tie, like, you know what I mean? That was like, okay, trust, authority. Like, this is somebody who knows what they're talking yeah. about. But I think that has really switched, you know, it's kind of like really like almost gone the opposite way. Whereas I think a lot of people, they'd rather see like a regular person be like, hey, I went to this place and this is what I think, or, you know, this is what I heard. I think a lot of younger people are getting their news that way, and I think that's going to continue. So I think we should really like broaden, you know, our horizons as far as like letting people on camera who don't particularly like, you know, fit any like mold. You know, even in the comments too, like when people are saying, people are commenting like, oh, who is this, like, you know, comparing me to Ellen DeGeneres and, you know, Megan Rapinoe, like the soccer player. And I was like, man, like those are the only two people you can think of that kind of look like,
yeah,
it's a really sad state of affairs. Like, this is 2026. And like, there's only two other people you can like, kind of, you know what I mean? Like, somewhat look like me and don't even work in the same fields,
right?
That you're making that comparison. And I think that really illustrates the real need for like, you know, people of other, you know, just people who look different, you know, to be on camera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'll get off my soapbox now.
No, I love that.
All right, I'll get back on.
I think it's so true. And, you know, news anchors, typically, like, if you have an accent, you have to train that accent out of yourself before you become a news anchor, right? Like, this is a big thing. And it is, you know, part of that is, like, people are moving around for those jobs all the time. But you've been in Boston your whole career. And I saw there were a lot of funny comments, which we will get to on that original video, but there were also a lot of really poignant comments. And one comment I saw on TikTok was somebody saying, I wish more reporters sounded like knowledgeable locals like this person instead of that generic news reporter voice, which I just thought was like cool. And you've talked a little bit about how, you know, you sound like a Bostonian. And so when you go into neighborhoods and are trying to report on things, sometimes people trust you more because you sound like the guy from down the block rather than like, you know, the parachute news anchor coming in their suit and tie.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's really helped me with, you know, talking to people and doing all the reporting that I've done at the Globe. Whenever they send me out into neighborhoods, I have background, you know, and, you know, I've lived here. I went to school here. I went to college here at Northeastern. So, you know, some of my classmates are like, how do you still have the accent? I'm like, well, you know, a lot of, you know, I saw a lot of my friends like go away to college, you know what I mean? And that's like kind of like when they lost their accent or whatever, but I never went anywhere. So, yeah. And I think it's really helped. And, you know, I heard from a lot of broadcast journalists who messaged me and said that, you know, like how they actually went to school and were told like, you know, you have to get rid of it. And I also have some like high school classmates who are also journalists kind of joking, like, you know, wishing they had their accent back, you know, but yeah. And I think like accents in general too are kind of fading away, you know? And so I think it's like a little bit of nostalgia as well. I've been, you know, I never really thought about like put this much thought into how I talk in the past few weeks, but you know, I even heard like a news report the other day, you know, saying that, you know, people are, in general are talking less, you know, and even that may have an impact on, you know, whether accents are passed down or not.
Interesting. Yeah. You seem to be like sort of like a nerd or at least super knowledgeable about like the particulars of the accent. I saw some comments in which you were like describing the difference between how an R is produced at the end of the word versus in the middle of the word. And I was like, I've never thought about this. Like, are accents something you study?
Yeah, no, I'm no linguist. Look, like, but the past like 4 weeks, I actually started thinking, like, what does a Boston accent sound like? You know, and like, I never really, you know, sometimes if I heard one that was off, you could, you know, if you're watching a movie and it's like, oh, like, that doesn't sound right. It sounds more like New York. But, you know, in this different parts of Boston, people have different accents, but we're not going to, you know, if you can really go down a rabbit hole there, if you drill down. But, you know, I think one of the, if I was like a Hollywood acting coach, I would say, I think one thing that gets screwed up is like the ERs at the end of words, like power, like magical powers. If it's plural, it becomes I-Z.
Okay.
You know, it's not, yeah, powers, flowers. You know, that's one thing that gets, I think, lost sometimes when people are trying to replicate the accent. And yeah, so I've just become a new expert in it because I've given thought to it the past few weeks, you know, so.
Okay, so your accent presumably is Dorchester specific. You grew up in Dorchester.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Dorchester and like I definitely talk like my mother and my brother. My dad also has a Dorchester accent, but it's like almost like more old school. So like, I would say like horseback riding, right? My dad would say hoss.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's like, cause it's super old school, but I didn't really pick that up. And sometimes like Dorchester will be called Dot. Cause like my dad would say Dorchester. So.
Okay. Yeah. So I read you have a dot rat tattoo and you identify as a dot rat. So tell me about what a dot rat is.
Dorchester is like the biggest neighborhood in Boston. And, you know, some of the areas, you know, very working class. And I think probably the word came about as being like a degrading term, like, oh, he's from, you know, Dorchester, dot rat. But then it, you know, became embraced by local folks. And so, growing up, like you'd be a dot rat. We'd have a Dorchester Day parade. They'd sell like dot rat hats and everything. And so once I became old enough to get a tattoo, I got like in old English letters all across my back. Pretty big too. It says dot rat. And yeah, very proud of that.
That's awesome. So tell me a little bit about your life growing up in Dorchester. What Dorchester was like, what you were like, sort of where Emily Sweeney came from.
It was a very working class neighborhood, very diverse. And probably the biggest takeaway would be a lot of adults weren't around because they were all working, you know, and a lot of us kids were, you know, we were like latchkey children running in packs. And yeah, it was a great place to grow up. You know, I had a blast. You know, I remember there was one night that, you know, I was like, I think we were like watching TV with my mother and my mother's boyfriend at the time. And we hear like a crash and some guy put his head through our front door window and crawled through and was hiding from the police. You know, and so, like, you know, my mom's boyfriend runs down and is, like, trying to, like, get him out and stuff. But, you know, stuff like that, like, living in the city, just, like, stuff like that happening. It was, like, sometimes, like, when I tell stories, people are like, what? Like, yeah. You know, and I'm like, you know, I think we grew up a little differently, but it's all good. And, like, I got, and this is kind of a crazy story. Like, my dad's a little wild and crazy, but, you know, when I was, like, 13 years old, you know, living in Dorchester, it's Christmas time. I'm like, Dad, like, what's this? Like, it's like wicked heavy box. And I open it up and it's a 22. It's a gun. My mother's like, Jesus Christ, Bob, what are you doing? Are you effing kidding me? I was like, you know, so I always remember that Christmas. But, you know, and my dad taught me how to shoot up in Maine, not Dorchester.
Okay.
and so it was just a very, yeah. I have lots of weird stories, but that's a little taste.
So you went to Boston Latin, and you were the first girl to play on the hockey team?
Varsity, yeah. Yeah, so I grew up playing Dorchester youth hockey. There were no girls. There was a girl ahead of me who played, Stephanie O'Sullivan. She was amazing. She was a couple of years older than me. And but other than that, like, it was just like, you know, it was just me and the boys, and just like Stephanie, like, we grew up playing on the boys teams, and it was just like totally normal, you know? And, in high school, there was no, you know, Boston Latin now has a girls hockey team. Most of the high schools, like, around have girls hockey, you know, now it's like, it's grown so much. It's great to see. But at the time, yeah. So I had to play on the boys hockey team, and, but it just seemed normal, you know? It was probably weird starting to play girls hockey, because it was like, wow, like, what? Oh, you know, it was, that was probably a bigger change, because I grew up just playing with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on to Northeastern and played 4 years there for Northeastern.
On the women's team?
On the women's team, yes.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
And were you doing journalism at Northeastern?
Yeah, so I actually... is another kind of funny story. So, you know, I wanted to go to medical school originally. Mm-hmm. And so I started out as a pharmacy major at Northeastern, because that would fulfill the requirements to get into med school. And when I started playing hockey, though, the labs started interfering with practices. So I had to make a choice. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as a teenager, I was like, well, hockey is most important, clearly. Yeah. And what's the most important, you know, I mean, what's like a major that will fit with hockey? And journalism was, like, you know, my second choice. And I always worked in media, like, you know, even as a kid growing up, I would make, like, newspapers and, you know, draw. And I've always been writing. And so it was definitely a good pick. Like, Thank God, it was the best thing.
And at that point, as a college student, like, what are you thinking of as what you want your journalism career to be?
You know, I mean, originally, I wanted to do broadcast journalism, mm-hmm. like, do video, do, like, you know, camera work. But again, I just, like, looked at it realistically, you know, like how I looked and how I wanted to, like, you know, I used to dress like a lot more like punk, like, you know, and I was like, there's no way I'm dressing like all corporate, blah, blah, blah. Like, and so I went into print journalism. And another thing that I actually, you know, drew me to the Globe is that Northeastern has a co-op program, which is, you know, it's like pretty much an internship. Like half your time there is you're studying or you're doing like your internship. And my co-op at the Globe as a college student really sealed the deal and like made me want to go into journalism because, you know, seeing how the newsroom operated, just seeing how editors like gave out stories, people running out the door to cover something, hearing reporters like interview people, just the constant like, and then like seeing everything come out in the paper the next day, just, you know, the daily miracle that like drew a lot of us to it.
Mm-hmm.
Being in it and in that room with so many different like competing personalities, I was like, you know, reminded me of like, you know, a little bit maybe of like a hockey locker room, you know, and
yeah.
And like just like the teamwork involved, you know, it made me want to work for the Globe. And they hired me a few years later.
So that wasn't your very first job out of college?
No, I worked, I did a few short stints at some local papers. After I graduated at the Globe, you know, the Globe editors were like, you know, you have to go to work for smaller papers. You can't just stay here working at the Globe. Because I was like, I was taking every co-op shift I could, working at the State House Bureau, City Hall Bureau. I was like, you know, willing to do like manual labor. You know what I mean? Like I was, they're like, you have to go if you want to come back. And eventually I got a job at a paper called the Bedford Minuteman, which is a suburb, like a little, like kind of like northwest of Boston. And from there, soon after that, I went to the Brookline Tab and then the Waltham Daily News Tribune. And I was at the Waltham Daily News Tribune, like, not even like a matter of like, I don't even know if I made it a month there, but the Globe hired me to cover Waltham, like kind of stole me from there to cover Waltham for the Globe.
And you've been there ever since. How long now?
This will be my 25th year on staff.
Wow. Yeah. I feel like in journalism, careers at an individual outlet are generally so short these days that it feels rare to meet someone, especially somebody who's not like already in their 70s, right? Who's been at one place that much of their career. Like that's super cool to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to say, you know, the Globe has been really good to me. It's been a great place to work. And, you know, we've, so much has happened too. Like in, like, you know, Spotlight, I got to see like, you know, kind of like Spotlight being made and then it wins an Oscar, like, you know, and everybody in the movie, I'm like, oh my God, those are like, that's our colleagues, you know, and the incredible work that we do like all the time. It's, you know, it's been an honor, you know, to work for the Globe and for this long.
And you've covered a lot of breaking news, as you said. You've also developed a real expertise in organized crime in Boston. You've written a couple of books about that. Mm-hmm. And your most recent book about the wrestler Dropkick Murphy, which I'm really excited to read. But tell me about your interest in organized crime as a Boston-specific thing to cover.
Yeah, so organized crime, you know, when I was working at the Brookline Tab, I'm like a huge history buff. I love doing research. And it was actually in Brookline. Brookline's a very like affluent community that's like right next to Boston. You know, it's and it's very small. And I was struck by how many mobsters lived in Brookline, honestly. And I was like, I went to my editor. I was like, can we do a story about like Brookline's mob ties? And my editor was like, what? Like, are you kidding me? Because, like, you know, again, it's very affluent. It's known for its school system. But, you know, look at mobsters. They also want, you know, good schools. They want safe neighborhoods to live in. Yeah. And so we did a big story. Like, it ended up being, like, a cover story of, like, I took up like, the whole cover they gave me about all the ties to organized crime that Brookline had. And also, I think that helped me get hired at the Globe because the Globe editors also saw that story. So from there, I did a similar thing at the Globe when they hired me. I was like, you know, just kind of like a big map of like all the major landmarks and all the different, you know, things that happened in all these places in Boston that were tied to the mob. And then I got offered to do a book. And so it's just kind of snowballed from there. But it's really just like my curiosity, my interest in history and Brookline. And like, you know, whenever I see, I don't know, I just never take anything at face value. Even like, you know, when I saw like all these like, you know, Brookline, I'm like, it's so fancy and nice. And I'm like, something's lurking here, you know? I don't know if it's like paranoia that I have built in or
reporter brain,
you know? And yeah, so from there, like, ended up doing it like another book too about organized crime.
Cool. And then tell me about this most recent book about Dropkick Murphy. I did not know that the band was named after a real guy.
Yeah. So, the Dropkick Murphys, who, you know, we all know and love, maybe at least I do. And,
everybody in Boston loves.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's always been like kind of lore that like they were named after this, like if you're like a hardcore fan of the Dropkick Murphys, you've probably heard that they were named after a real guy. You know, being the researcher and like a history buff that I am, I'm like, who was this guy, you know? And the more I found out about John Murphy, the guy who would become Dropkick Murphy, I just became more and more fascinated and impressed by what he accomplished during his life. So he was a professional wrestler back in the 1930s and 40s. He started like right at the end of the Great Depression. And you know, it was really interesting to like see professional wrestling was kind of like how it is now with like all these like characters with backstories. And he put himself through medical school that way. Like he was working as a professional wrestler, saving up money, went through all 4 years of medical school, graduated. When he was out of medical school, he was doing so well wrestling professionally all across the country that he continued to do that as a pro wrestler. And at the same time, he bought a farm out in Acton, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. And he turned the farm into a detox center for alcoholics and people battling addiction. And is kind of the Betty Ford Clinic, you know, of its time. And it was also, he also had like a full regulation size, like boxing/wrestling ring at the farm and all this state-of-the-art fitness equipment. And he opened the doors up to professional athletes who wanted to train there and also the public, like anybody who wanted to work out or get like personal training sessions. And now, like, this is the 1940s, like, you know, just to see like him putting ads in the local paper, like, you know, come down, get in shape, like exercise and, you know, with these classes and stuff. I just thought it was so interesting. And, you know, the research took years. And at first I thought it would be like maybe like an article for the Globe I could do. And then it grew. I thought, okay, maybe a Globe magazine article. And then I was like, hey, you know what? This is a book. And I've, you know, with the constraints that I had, like, you know, obviously writing a nonfiction book, I wasn't there. So I, you know, God only knows the dialogue that was going on. Like if you have like 20 guys from all walks of life trying to dry out together. And just the crazy stories that like Dropkick's children told me of stuff that happened there. I think it would be an amazing movie or like a television series, you know? So that's still my hope. Because I think.
So Ben Affleck better be hitting up your line.
Right. Do you hear that, Ben? I hope you're listening. CJR.
Now that you've replaced him as Boston's most famous person. I love how excited about Boston history you are. You spent so many years researching this book. You got really into the history of organized crime. I think my favorite video of yours is talking about the statue that's now at the Museum of Fine Arts, but it used to just like be hanging out in Jamaica Plain. And so I guess I should just have you tell that story because I find it really fascinating.
I'm sure like growing up, you guys had urban legends, right? Where you lived, like, you know, of many sorts. You know, so where I grew up, when I started going to Boston Latin, the statue wasn't in Dorchester. It was like in it's on the border of Jamaica Plain and Brookline, kind of near West Roxbury. And people would talk about the Statue of Gloria. Like it was like this supposedly a statue named after a nurse who was killed. And none of that, from what I can tell, is true. And supposedly if you drove up to it, you could see her cry blood. So as teenagers, you know, we'd all like pile into somebody's station wagon and drive up there and just like, you know, suddenly it's really dark. There were no streetlights up there from what I remember. And, you know, you're in the city, but you feel like you're not in the city anymore suddenly. And then like you're driving down a long driveway. And then suddenly there's this like this gigantic, bright white statue that's huge. And like, you know, the moonlight's like shining off of it. It's missing like a nose. So it kind of looks like a skull more like a skull or head. And of course, every girl in the car is like screaming like, ah! Like, you know, and then we'd like drive away, you know, or run away. And so the Statue of Gloria, like, I think it was around 2011, disappeared. So you know, kids didn't go up there anymore. The jump scare no longer existed. And it was just recently that I found out that the statue was actually bought by the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And it turns out the statue is just over 2,000 years old. It's Roman and it's gigantic. I went to see it for the first time. The last time I had seen it was in the wild outside as a teenager. And I got to see it just recently for the first time in its like new home at the museum. And they restored her face so she no longer looks like a skull. Like she has a nose now. It's like back to how she like used to look back in the day. But yeah, it was so cool seeing it. And I got to say, I mean, I remember her being really scary and I was so curious, like, is she going to give like spooky vibes or anything like that? And she did not. Right. It was like a really happy, and she's like way bigger than I remember. I was like, whoa, I was blown away. And so, my producer, Maria Pemberton at the Globe, caught my reaction on video of seeing it for the very first time since a teenager outside. But anybody who comes up to Boston, please go to the MFA. The official name of the statue is Juno. And it's one of the largest classical marble statues in North America, or if not the largest. Wow. And it's very, very impressive. And now you have the extra backstory that you know that it used to be a jump scare and the urban legend behind it.
My favorite part of that video is the first like 2 seconds, because we see you walking in.
Yeah.
And your reaction to seeing it after having these childhood experiences with it is so genuine. And you are clearly just like truly blown away by what you are seeing, which is so fun to watch.
I really was. Like, I gotta tell you, I still am like, how does it seem so much bigger? I was like, that's what really blew me away was the size. I was like, there's no way this is 13 feet. I honestly wanted to take like a tape measure, but you know, I couldn't get that close to it. But And I assume the museum knows what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. They got the measurements right. But it's like, it's really, really impressive. It's like way bigger than I remembered.
Yeah, this is part of why I wanted to talk to you, is like your video work, your like enthusiasm for whatever you're covering is so infectious. And I feel like a lot of journalists kind of lose that over time, in part because like you're told you have to be professional and come across a certain way, in part because I think people get jaded, right? It's a long, like hard career. So how have you like maintained that genuine joy in your work?
Yeah, so for one, I love talking to people and interviewing people and hearing their stories and learning about them. Like, every single time doing Man on the Street interviews, there's always like you always get a surprise no matter what, you know, that somebody will tell like a funny story that you weren't expecting or, I really, really enjoy. And also with the video, I'm always like trying to think of just different ways. Like I'm excited just because of like this kind of new opportunity for me, and just, I have like lots of creative ideas, some of which don't go over well, but I'm trying. You know, for example, I've been trying to like have my editors, like whenever I do Man on the Street videos, I've been like, can I just like wear my rollerblades? And so far, like I've been like told like kind of like, no, like, you know, but
one on rollerblades, right?
I did. I did like a news report while I was taking shots, playing street hockey. And I would like to do that again. And I would like to interview people on rollerblades. I don't know what it is, but I'm like, it's on my bucket list, you know? If you got to see a man, you got to do Man on the Street. Like, why not, like, I don't know, report on blades.
I'll subscribe to Emily Sweeney's rollerblade report for sure.
Right? You know, and then like, you know, God forbid, what's the worst that could happen? I fall. Oh, hey, it's funny. Like, I don't know. Like, it's...
Sure. So going back to the initial video that sort of transformed everybody's thoughts about you, about vertical video, about all of it, the comments were hilarious. There were comments from a lot of famous people. Like I saw Ava DuVernay in your Instagram comments. And, you know, the comments were super funny. I mean, my favorite, like, I grew up on the West Coast. I'm married to a New Englander. So okay, I am like, I'm more familiar with the Rhode Island accent than the Boston accent, which I have been taught are different.
they are very.
But my favorite comment was the home invader also stole all the R's. Like, that's just good. But I also think, like, when you go, I've never gone as viral as you, but when I've gone less viral than that, there's always this like moment of like, oh shit, like, are they making fun of me? Are they like, do they like me? You know, and accent stuff, I feel like can be really fraught because there's like class involved. There's like stereotype involved, all of that. So like, tell me about what your thought process was like figuring out like, you know, how you felt about going viral in this way.
First off, I was just happy that the video got a lot of views because it, you know, directs people's attention to the globe, the story. Like that's, you know, that's what we're going for when we make the videos. And then as far as like me personally, you know, I'm always like ready to address any like question or concern. And in the past, sometimes people have like made comments about my accent, but I mean, everything was overwhelmingly positive. Like I was just like, am I like living in some type of weird dream world? Like, like I was ready to like encounter, you know, you usually have a share of trolls who are out there, and I have no problem engaging, you know? And, yeah, so it was overwhelmingly positive, and I'm still like shocked about that. Mm. And it's just really nice to see. And I also, you know, have reflected probably for the first time ever, like on how I speak. And, you know, when I saw a couple like people saying like, oh, you're exaggerating the accent. I pulled up a video that I had made like 20 years before just to see.
Oh my God.
And I played it. I was like, oh my God, it sounded exactly the same. And then I even found a thing from like me when I was 8 years old. I was like pretending to host a radio show, and I played it, and my voice sounds like Alvin and the Chipmunks, very high, but still the same.
I talked to a friend. I told a friend that I was interviewing you. This friend has described you as her celebrity crush. And I said, what do you want to know? And she said, I need to know how many track jackets you have. So please tell us about your track jacket collection.
Oh, wow. You know, so I have never counted them. Number one. So I don't have an answer, unfortunately. That number is growing, though, because I've been, I have bought some new ones on eBay. And yeah, so that's been my like little treat to myself, because whenever I'd get like, I don't know, like some people like hats or like shoes or, you know what I mean? Like I've always loved track jackets. And so, yeah, my collection is definitely growing, but I have been trying to wear a different one in every Globe video. So I still have a bunch that I haven't worn yet. So ooh, I'll have to count them though. I'm not sure.
Okay. You can get back to us.
I will.
And then you've been super engaged in all of the comments. Like you're going back and forth with people, you're chopping it up. When people have said like, you know, we want Emily to do the news every day, you're like, yeah, tell my bosses, you know, yeah. Which is fun. And as a journalism story, like I'm interested in that as a method of like reaching people, right? And coming across as more approachable. So what has it been like to, I assume, spend quite a bit of your time sort of going back and forth in those comments?
Yeah, so, you know, that's like one thing. I want to respond to everybody, which sometimes it's become like almost impossible, you know? But I've always done that. Even on my Globe stories, you know, like I will comment and write back. Like the first thing I read a lot of news stories, I read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, like all the major like papers. I read all the comments all the time. Yeah. I've done that for forever. And I just, yeah. And I've always wanted to like, you know, even chime in on those newspapers, but I'm like, all right, that might be crossing a line. Like, as a Globe journalist, like, commenting, and you're not supposed to express opinions, obviously, if you're a journalist. So, you know, I think it's another, like, turning point, I think, in our industry is that I think in general, if I had to give advice, or this is at least how I see it, is that, like, more reporters need to get on camera, like, especially if they want to, you know, it, like, not, they shouldn't be forced to, but, like, if you're into it, you should, absolutely. And I think engaging with commenters, both good and bad, I've had a really positive experiences, like, engaging with some of the people who are being trolls, you know, not to mince words, but if it doesn't bother you too much, you should, you know, for journalists to just engage with everybody if possible. You know, when people say, like, the Globe sucks, you know, I'm always like, why? Like, you know, and then sometimes I get responses, sometimes I don't, but, and often it sometimes quiets those people down. Like, even just everybody getting news, like, especially younger people from TikTok, that the engagement is just so high. And also just, like, live stream, like, Twitch, Kick, like, people aren't just, like, sitting back watching. Mm-hmm. They want to throw in, they want to engage, they want to comment. They want to comment in real time. And I think that's also, I would like to do more of that, but with journalism, doing more, like, live streaming and also, like, answering people's questions and kind of, like, pulling back the curtain to how we work, because, like, I feel like the general public doesn't know, like, the amount of work that a journalist does for any given story, you know, all the fact checking involved, all the phone calls involved. So it's the probably for the first time in my career that, like, I'm, like, seriously considering just other, like, forms of media besides, like, you know, writing.
It also feels like it's, like, a way to create sort of a new relationship with readers that isn't as passive as, like, you produce the work and they consume it. And you seem, like, really smart and forward thinking about that. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you think about that.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I'm very lucky to be working with our social media team at the Globe, and the video team has been, like, very open to suggestions. And me, I'm totally open to suggestions. I'm like, I'm down to do almost, like, whatever. And, you know, we've made a call out to people to, like, you know, leave comments about, like, you know, what they'd like to see covered, which has been great. People have come up with, like, some amazing ideas. I've gotten so many messages from people with, like, story tips and ideas. And one of the best compliments I've been given, you know, during this time, and has been just from a lot of people saying that they trust me, and, you know, without knowing me personally, but they feel like they're getting to know me, and there's trust there. And I'm not, like, exactly sure, you know, where that comes from. I think part of it may be my accent. I don't sound like a normal, typical, broadcaster, or, like, you know, some type of, like, authority figure. I might also be, like, the way I dress, you know, like, just more of, like, a typical kid on the street, you know. It's probably, like, a multitude of factors, but it's been really, really cool to hear people say that. And they're saying that to a Globe reporter, to somebody who works for a legacy media organization. And it's given me, like, a lot of hope. And made me, I was always excited about journalism. Now I'm, like, even more excited.
I love that. What a good note to end on. Well, Emily Sweeney, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, Megan, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. The Kicker is a production of the Columbia Journalism Review. I'm your host, Megan Greenwell, and our producer is Amanda Dara. You can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love if you liked and subscribed. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.